My castaway this week is a writer and performer. Tall, public school and Cambridge educated, he appears at first glance to epitomise the sort of character he's lampooned for most of his life. He became famous at the end of the 60s as the tallest and many thought the funniest member of the team who made Monty Python's Flying Circus. He followed this with the hotel owner Basil Fawlty, who in only 12 episodes for television displayed the repressed rage of a manic Englishman in a way which has engraved itself on the national consciousness. Since then, he's concentrated on films, The Life of Brian, Clockwise, and the hugely successful A Fish Called Wanda, whose sequel, Fierce Creatures, will be seen soon. "You feel an enormous pressure to conform," he once said. "A lot of what I've been doing is attempting to escape from that." He is John Cleese. So you don't like conformity, John. It's something to be avoided, is it?
I think it's something to be very suspicious of.
But there's a great comfort in it.
Yes. Oh, yes. You can feel much safer like that. Much safer. But I think sometimes as I get older and I look around, I think the world is even sillier and madder than I used to think it was even when I was doing Monty Python. And therefore, I think it's awfully important to try to make up your own mind about what you think about things and not take the established wisdoms.
Certainly, but at the same time, you want to stay comfortable. I mean, it's why children like wearing uniform or baseball caps backwards or whatever. We like being the same. Why did you feel you wanted to be different, had to be different?
I think that I went through the kind of training that enabled me to take on that middle-class appearance very, very easily, almost too easily. I could slip into it just at the drop of a hat. And I think I was always a little suspicious of it.
So you decided to build on that and make people laugh as a result. But was the desire to make people laugh, did that come first, or was it the desire to break out of this conformity?
Oh, gosh, the easy ones first. I think that the desire to make people laugh came out of the fact that I was a typical child of older parents, a little bit more withdrawn, a little more thoughtful, apparently more intelligent, but much less likely to be in the rough and tumble. And I was certainly like that when I first went to prep school. And I don't think I was disliked that much, but I certainly wasn't one of the boys. And I discovered that I could make the form laugh when I'd been there about a year. And that is not only a nice feeling, because when people laugh at something you said, you feel very good, you feel terrific. But at the same time, I felt that I became much more popular as a result.
And to make them laugh a lot by being shocking.
By being shocking, certainly, yes, because humour is critical. It's always basically attacking something, usually the status quo.
But whatever must your parents have thought, these neat and tidy people from Western Street from there, when they came to see you in the footlights or whatever, you know, suddenly to see this son they thought they brought up so nice, being so rude, abusive.
Well, I have to say that they both had a great sense of humour. My father had a sense of the ridiculous, whereas my mother has got a different sense of humour. She's got a very black sense of humour. Very, very black. And I can make her laugh if she gets a bit depressed, and after all, when you're 97, as she is now, you know, it's not that much fun being that old. So when she starts telling me that that life's difficult at that age, I tell her that I have a little man in Fulham who's very nice, who will come down to Weston-super-Mare and kill her when she no longer wants to continue.
And she
loves it. And I tell her if she has a friend, you know, who also is tired of life, then he'll do a special offer for two. And this immediately makes her laugh. So she and I can communicate through this actually very black sense of humour.
Tell me about your first record.
First record is Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. And I remember going to see the movie in Weston-super-Mare when I was about 10 with my parents. It was black and white. I can't even remember who was in it. But there was something about it that appealed to me, and there's something about New York that always has appealed to me, and I think of Rhapsody in Blue as being New York.
Thank you.
part of Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue with Michael Tilson Thomas and the Los Angeles Philharmonic. You grew up, John Cleese, in Weston-super-Mare in the sort of late 40s, early 50s. Tell me about it. A lot of jellyfish, I remember.
A lot of jellyfish, a lot of mud. And it was alleged that there was some sand under the mud. Last time I made remarks like this, I'm afraid I got cross letters. So I have to say, it's a very decent little town, but not in the early 50s, full of excitement. And I'm afraid I used to spend an awful lot of mornings in the snooker saloon above Burton's, the 50-shilling tailors.
It's not the impression I have of you at all. I imagine you was like something out of the Famous Five, you know, sort of Enid Blyton schoolboy with long, short trousers and three-quarter socks and open sandals.
Well, it's certainly true that I was so tall so early that I did look ridiculous in shorts. I was 6 foot when I was 12, so I was taller at the age of 12 than any of the teachers in the school that I was at.
It was huge for 12.
It was enormous. Well, and it was very strange because, of course, you stick out. One of the teachers once jokingly referred to me as a prominent citizen. You stick out in such a way that you can't just fade into the background, as you want to do a lot when you're a kid and you're embarrassed.
What effect did that have on you then?
I think it taught me, like every English class boy, to pretend that I was a lot more grown up than I was.
You were an only child.
Only
you?
Child,
I think
yeah.
Your mother said that you were born just after the outbreak of war, but you were a bit of a bombshell anyway, because they didn't expect to have one.
No, that's right. They'd been together for 13 and a half years, and I think that they'd assumed that they wouldn't have children. But as you say, I was what Eric Idle calls a phony war baby. And for some reason, the first few years of my life, we just travelled everywhere, because the Germans bombed Weston-super-Mare quite early on in the war. As I always say, who says they have no sense of humour?
And your father sold insurance.
That's right.
And drove around in Little Austin 10.
Little Austin 10, and sold insurance, and he was a very decent, honest chap, and all the local solicitors and bank managers trusted him. So Dad used to start work about 10:30 in the morning and finish at about 4, and every year managed to sell more life assurance for the Guardian, as it was then, insurance company.
But he had done something quite racy, hadn't he? He changed his name.
Yes, because he was born Reginald Francis Cheese. Got fed up with the teasing when he was at school, and when he joined the army in 1915, he changed the H to an L. It was strange because he was, for some reason, he was embarrassed about the fact he'd changed it. I don't really know why. But he had a sister called Dorothy Cheese, who actually lived with us in Bristol in the 50s. And when people said, how strange you should have someone living in your house called Dorothy Cheese, he would say, yes, extraordinary coincidence. So I never knew what the shame was.
Record number two.
Because of all my happy days with the Pythons, I would like to have a reminder of all those relationships.
Why are we here? What's life all about? Is God really real? Or is there some doubt? Well, tonight we're going to sort it all out. But tonight it's the meaning of life. What's the point of all these hoaxes? Is it the chicken and the egg time? Are we just jokes?
Eric Idle and the Meaning of Life. There are so many characters in that film, John. Well, it's a series of extended sketches, really, isn't it, that must have their roots in yours. You know, the blundering army officers, the pompous, ponderous schoolmaster. You know.
Yes, and particularly the service in the chapel. I remember sitting in all those interminable Church of England services, just thinking, what is all this about? Year after year after year.
So that was at Clifton College, Bristol, where you...
That was at Clifton, yeah. I went there in the mid-50s, yeah.
But were a lot of the characters you've used, be it in that film or in other sketches or whatever, in Monty Python generally, you know, born of people you knew in Weston-super-Mare who attended your parents' sherry parties or whatever? Were there a lot of pinstripe folk around?
No, I don't think I've ever been terribly good on basing characters on individuals. I think I have a certain ability sometimes to kind of focus in on archetypes. And when I started to be funny, or to try and be funny, I simply realised as a matter of practice that what is funny is people's lives unravelling. You know, if you have a film in which somebody gets happier and more organized, it's not going to be a comedy. And therefore, the more respectable and apparently in charge they are at the beginning of the film or the sketch, the funnier it is when they become unraveled. Because if they started
as someone who was kind of unemployed and watching television all day and drinking too much lager, there wouldn't be anywhere to go. You see what I mean? The unravelling wouldn't have any consequences, whereas if the guy is in charge of the British Secret Service, which is one of the first sketches I ever did, there are rather a lot of consequences, and that makes it funnier when his life unravels.
But you were supposed to be one of those people, in a sense, weren't you? I mean, your parents
Dad
wanted
you. Yes, Dad wanted me to join Grace Derbyshire and Todd, Chartered Accountants of Bristol, when I was just after I'd taken my O-levels. And bless him, I don't know why, but I said I want to go to university. None of my family had ever been anywhere near university, but there was something in me that wanted it. And we were not wealthy, but my parents made, sacrifices. They were very kind, and I'm grateful for that, which enabled me to stay on until I could get a place at Cambridge 2 years later.
Next record.
One of the things I feel very pleased that I've done, if I could be smug for a moment, is I started the Amnesty concerts. And the great problem about the Amnesty concerts was you had so many funny people that the temperature, the excitement, the level of expectation for humour would become so high that at a certain point you had to diffuse it. And I would always ask dear John Williams to play a piece, and then you'd cool the audience off so that they could start laughing again.
John Williams and Cavatina. You're obviously, though, John, a very good boy. I mean,
yes, this has been the problem all my life, but...
but was the discovery of Footlights, when you got to Cambridge, was that the beginning of John, please, going off the rails in the eyes of Weston-super-Mare?
Oh, absolutely, I'm sure it was. And the funny thing was, when I first went up to the Footlights desk at the big society's fair at the beginning, it was this terribly embarrassing scene. I said I might be rather interested in joining, and they said brightly, oh, do you sing? No, I was never allowed to sing at school. I was given extra Greek. I was so terrible. So I said no. And they said, do you dance? And I said, well, no, not really. And I fled in confusion. And if my closest friend really hadn't come to me about two terms later and said, do you want to do something with me at the Footlights? I know someone in it. I'm not necessarily sure that I would have ever got in it.
Then what would have happened to you?
Well, I think I would have become a solicitor and either shot myself or started to write funny bits for Punch. I think I would have been drawn eventually into, oddly enough, into writing. Because for some strange reason, I've never quite understood performing. I know people would be surprised, but it's never meant that much to me. I don't think I've ever been envious of another actor. And somebody once said, if you want to see what matters to people, see who they're envious of. And I've always felt envious of people like Tom Stoppard and Alan Ayckbourn or Michael Frayn, these kind of people, David Mamet, with a body of writing behind them, either for stage or for screen.
It's just that Footlights required that you did both, I suppose.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I mean, there were a few performers in Footlights, but they didn't get to do much because the ones who wrote the stuff wanted to perform it themselves. And that's really what the Pythons were about. People don't understand
understand the Python group, it was actually six writers who used to perform it because they were less likely to screw it up than six other performers who might have been brought in.
But in the end, because you all wrote together, it became writing by committee and you got exasperated.
Well, we had a wonderful experience on Life of Brian because fortuitously we all seemed to have the same basic philosophy about organized religion. So the thing was a dream. When we got to Meaning of Life, we never knew what the film was going to be about. There was a big selection of sketches written, and we kept trying to unify it into a story. And in the end, I suggested we should just give up. We went to Barbados for 2 weeks for a holiday, and after 3 days, I said, let's stay and enjoy ourselves for 10 days, have a wonderful holiday, and then go back and pretend that we're sort of at our wits' end, and we just creatively were total failures and we're not going to make the film. And I nearly won the day, but Jones came down the next morning and said, oh, you know, I really believe we could make this really good. And we came up with a film which for me was scrappy and unsatisfactory in as much as I did not think that we put the best material in. But it's probably just as well, because Graham and I had written a series of sketches about the Ayatollah Khomeini, which really could not have been any more abusive and rude. And had they been in the film, we would probably both be under a fatwa. Maybe that's the problem with Graham.
More music.
Well, now I either seem to like music that I find in some way touching, or I like sort of rowdy, cheerful music. And I knew I was going to have something by Scott Joplin. So I played through, and I thought Maple Leaf Rag was as cheerful and rowdy a piece as I could find.
Scott Joplin's Maple Leaf Rag, played by Sidney Bechet with the New Orleans Feet Warmers, and that was recorded in 1932. And I can see you, John, you know, going mad on the beach, really, dancing to
it. It's rather like farce. It's got the same frenzied energy that farce has. But when you have a farce, you have this wonderful combination of an almost mathematically perfect shape and then all this madness within it. And I love that, that I'm very aware of the structure in that music we've just been listening to, as well as this glee.
That's what you felt, I think, isn't it, in writing about Basil Fawlty, writing Fawlty Towers, that it was a very intricately structured thing, wasn't it, each one of those episodes?
Yes, I mean, it's the writing that Connie and I did that I always have felt most proud of. I know people think of the performance, but we spent about 6 weeks each on those half-hour scripts, which is unheard of. And I don't think we started writing the dialogue for at least 3 weeks. We just ran the story again and again. We told each other the story again and again and again until we sort of flattened out the bumps.
But what Basil had, obviously, was, again, what I mentioned at the beginning, repressed rage. Mm-hmm. And he had that in common with a tremendous number of the funny characters that you created, whether they were architects who, as you said, began life as being very conventional characters and then suddenly burst out full of anger and abuse.
And everything. I mean, I knew a guy called Harvey Orkin years ago, and he said to me, John, he said, humor is about anger, it's about lust, it's about envy, it's about greed. And then he paused and he said, you show me a sitcom about St. Francis of Assisi and I'll show you a bummer. And I remember that when we constructed the poster for Wanda, that's what we said. It was about lust, greed, anger, rage, envy and seafood. And that was in my mind. It's all about the worst aspects of human behavior.
But why do we laugh at that?
Because we all know that we have the emotions inside us. But what is funny is when people try to disguise how they're coming out. You see what I mean? Because if the emotion comes out in a very straightforward way, it's not funny. It's always when it comes out in a disguised way, but we know what's really behind it. That's what makes it funny. Mm.
And always somebody is watching him. I mean, that's the other point about it, isn't it? That he never just bangs, he said, or kicks a car by himself. Somebody else is watching him doing it.
That's exactly right. Mad behavior is never funny unless there's someone looking at it thinking, what on earth is going on? And I remember learning that in the Marble Arch Odeon in about 1963, and I went to see the first Pink Panther, and there was this scene in the after a fancy dress ball, and they were all dressed as animals, stuffed animals, and a man comes out of a trattoria, who is obviously the worst for wear, and he goes back into the trattoria, emerges with a chair, puts the chair down, sits on it, crosses his arm, crosses his leg, and just watches. And that's when I realized that it wasn't very funny until you saw it through his eyes.
Record number 5.
Well, as I think I said, music either seems to sort of cheer me up or touch me, and I think of all the most romantic tunes I've ever heard. This touches me and almost has a physical effect on me.
Part of the prelude to Wagner's Tristan and Isolde, played by the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. It's a very romantic piece, John. Is romance, romantic love important to you?
I think it has been, and certainly when I was young, I made the mistake of thinking it was significant and led me into a number of relationships which probably... Well, hopefully I learned a lot from which were ill-fated.
But your marriage to Connie Booth, mm-hmm. you were talking about, with whom you wrote 40, broke up during the mid-70s and the writing of 40 Towers, and you became very depressed then. Is that when you began your therapy?
Yes, sessions? I mean, I think most people find the breakup of the first marriage is a kind of coming together of a whole lot of difficult strands of their life, and I guess I was... really fairly continuously depressed for probably 2 years, probably 75.
Seriously,
and 70.
Clinically depressed?
No, not unable to function. I mean, I never had to not go into work, but at the weekends I used to sit around and stare into the distance, and Robin Skinner, bless him, explained to me that there really is a function of being sad. In the old days, I used to take a Basil Fawlty attitude and say, what's the point in being depressed? We didn't win the war by being depressed. That sort of thought was genuinely the way that I'd been taught in Weston-super-Mare to think about it. And I realized that if you can be quiet and process emotions, actually allow yourself to be present with them, they begin to pass through you, and then you come out the other side.
And so together with Robin Skinner, you wrote a couple of books on how to survive families and how to survive life. I think. I wonder why you thought you were the ideal person to do that, really.
Well, I don't think I did think that, actually. I think my attitude was that I'd learned a certain amount being in the group with Robin, and my real motivation was to learn a lot more. Because if I look at my life, it's really always being about trying to understand how human beings' minds work, how mine works, how other people work.
But more so than the rest of us do.
I think so. I mean, if I hadn't had absolutely rotten teaching when I was at Clifton, I would have finished up, I'm absolutely sure, an academic psychologist somewhere, because that's what I was aiming at. It was just that the teaching in biology was so awful that I switched to the physics group. And in a sense, that interest came back in with experience with Robin, and writing the book with Robin was fascinating because it did enable me to make sense slowly of certain things I didn't understand before.
Let me put this to you, because one critic has said, I quote, "The conventional wisdom about John Cleese is that neurosis made him funny and sanity has made him dull," which seems rather harsh and actually rather difficult to justify. But nevertheless, is there a grain of truth in that?
My experience of therapy, I mean, once you have been given a little bit of creativity, which is no more than the ability to play, once you have that, I think that therapy can kind of open up the field so that you can go in areas where you might not have been able to go into before. For example, in Wander, I played a rather dull part, but it was a sort of romantic lead, or at least it was enough of a romantic lead to justify the comedy.
You became a sex symbol.
Well, so they tell me.
Irresistible.
I never noticed it, but I read about it in the papers. You know how they are. But what I mean is that softer side was something I would have had difficulty portraying on screen in front of lots of people if I think I hadn't had some of the therapy.
You'd have had difficulty taking your clothes off in front of lots of people.
No, that's surprisingly easy. I was quite surprised. I did a movie with Connie in 1974, which Sir Robert Young directed, and I had to spend a lot of that. It was an adaptation, a little short story by Chekhov, and I had to spend a lot of that naked. And the first time I took my underpants down, it was like going through an emotional sound barrier. I mean, it was almost as though the muscles froze. You know, you were unable, like running in mud in a dream. And about 3 days in, somebody said, "Okay, John, let's do the take." And I had to look down. I caught myself looking down to see whether my underpants were on or not. And I thought, this, you know, that's all social. You can go through those kind of fears very quickly.
Don't need therapy to cure
that. Not that one, no. Look, let me show you. It's very good.
Record number six, quick.
Record number six. I love people who have combined witty lyrics with tuneful music with a slightly eccentric beat. And I wondered whether to choose something by Randy Newman or something by Harry Nilsson. And in the end, I decided I'd choose Gotta Get Up by Harry Nilsson because it's how my life feels at the moment.
Get up, gotta get out, gotta get home before the morning comes. What if I'm late? Got a big day, gotta get home before the sun comes up. Up and away, got a big day, sorry, can't stay. I gotta run, run, yeah. Gotta get home, pick up the phone, gotta let the people know I'm gonna be late. We used to carry on and drink and do the rock and roll. We never thought we'd grow cold, but now gotta get up, gotta get out, gotta get home before the morning comes. What if I'm late? Got a big day, gotta get home before the sun comes up. Up and away, got a big day, sorry can't stay. I gotta run, run, yeah. Gotta get home, pick up the phone, gotta let the people know I'm gonna be late.
Harry Nilsson and Gotta Get Up. Now comes the sequel, as it were, to Wander, which is Fierce Creatures. Does it have anything in common with Wander other than the same rep company of actors?
No, that's exactly right. It's exactly like going to see the local rep, and last week they did this play with a different plot and different characters, and this week they're doing another one.
So this has been 8 years in the making, well in the writing.
True, but it's because making movies is it's a pretty much of a grind. I remember saying to Peter Cook when I saw Bedazzled many years ago, I said, you know, has it been fun? And he said, it's 2 years of your life, John.
You sound as if you find it a boring process.
Well, after 2.5 years, any filmmaker, I mean, they don't say this in interviews, but they all think, oh, thank God that's... But I shouldn't have said that. I didn't say it. I understand that because it's, you know, it's really been very exciting.
The awful thing for you is that you thought you'd finished it and then you hadn't because you had to redo the ending.
Well, it wasn't as bad as people think. And I'll tell you why, because we reshot the ending of Wanda twice, which most people don't realize. So when we showed this, and I was doubtful about whether the ending was good enough. One English audience had quite liked it, one had not liked it enough. So when we showed it in America, it was really a confirmation of my feeling that it wasn't good enough. It's worth getting them right. Otherwise, they sit there and you look at them and you think, oh gosh, I wish we'd done that bit better.
But that's also, that indicates that you're a perfectionist.
Yes.
You wouldn't deny that.
But that's the neurotic side, you see.
Is it?
Well, perfectionism is a kind of neuroticism.
Is it that you know, you've got so far to fall, I suppose, that everything
yes.
you've done, if you like, from Python through Faulty and on to Wonders, has been a great success.
Well, I've had my failures, but they've been buried fast and quietly.
Yeah, and efficiently.
And efficiently. So people have forgotten those, and the good things, thank God, keep getting repeated. But you're right, the trouble with Fierce Creatures, and it, I think is the only problem, is that the expectations will be too high to meet.
Record number 7.
I've had a brush with opera in the last few years, and I find that what bothers me about it is that the stories, the characterization, the dialogue and the acting, which are things I rather care about, seem to come at the bottom of the list in opera. On the other hand, the sound is magnificent, and this I find particularly magnificent.
Of the Easter hymn from Mascagni's Cavalleria Rusticana with Fiorenza Cossotto and Maria Grazia Allegri and the chorus and orchestra of La Scala Milan conducted by Herbert von Karajan. So there you are, on an island now. This is where we sent you. What happens to John Cleese on an island? Does
love
he?
It.
Oh, do
love
you?
It. Oh, yes.
I thought you'd probably top yourself.
No telephones. It would be absolutely wonderful. I went on a stress reduction weekend about 20 years ago, and on the Saturday you went into your room, they closed the door, the curtains were drawn, no television, no radio, nothing to read, and it was just being quiet. Meals left outside the door, knock knock, you never saw anyone, and after 24 hours they came to the door and said, it's all right, John, it's all over now. And I felt, oh, what is it now? In other words, this peace, this quiet, absolutely loved. So I think this desert island is gonna suit me very well.
And you'll survive happily then?
I think so.
Mentally, obviously, but physically, I mean, can you do all those things like building shelters? And
no. Yeah. Oh, no. No, that's right. I'll be dead in a week, come to think of it. I haven't looked at it like that. But I'll enjoy it up to that point.
Last record.
Last record, Louis Armstrong, What a Wonderful World, because the older I get, the more I realise how much there is to enjoy.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you. I hear babies cry. I watch them grow. They're like much more than I never knew. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful
world. Louis Armstrong and What a Wonderful World. If you could only take one of those records, John, which one would you choose?
Oh, Easter Hymn, I think. I have a sense that there's something going on that isn't just to do with the material world. I don't think that the Orthodox churches know a great deal about what it is, but I think there may be some kind of spiritual force around. How we get in contact with it is a rather different matter, a rather difficult one. And I think I would need something to keep my spirit alive, and I think the Easter Hymn touches me more than any of the others.
What about your book?
I thought I would ask for Tammy Wynette's autobiography, Stand By Your Man.
I see.
The reasoning behind that is I think I wouldn't get too upset if I lost it.
And your luxury?
Michael Palin, please.
You can't have Michael Palin. He's animate. You can have him stuffed.
Okay, that'll do.
John Cleese, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.